You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with an author chat with Yejin Su to talk about her debut YA fantasy novel, The Last Soldier of Nava. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying this podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you gain access to our members-only Discord server. You can chat with us and fellow book club members in real time about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly Patron Choice book club pick, the latest of which being the book we are reading this month. As always, thanks to everyone who has supported us on Patreon so far, and we'd always love to see more of you there.
Yeah, so we talked to Yejin about you know, her inspirations for this book, the Korean mythology behind it, developing her main characters, Shadow and Scarlet, who, you know, end up in a sapphic relationship, and also just talking about her publication journey. So I hope you guys enjoy this chat with Yejin Su. And we are here with Yejin Su, a Korean-American author based in New Jersey. Her debut YA fantasy, The Last Soldier of Nava, comes out this week. And we're very excited to have Yejin on our show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so we usually start our chats with a little icebreaker so we can ease into our conversation. And since your book, you know, you have the Dawnbringer and the Moonbearer, you know, day and night. I'm curious, are you a morning lark or a night owl?
I definitely say night owl, but I'm trying to be more of a morning lark nowadays.
I feel like the world is kind of more biased towards morning people, because as I'm also a night owl, I go to sleep at like 3 a.m. So it's just like, I feel like it's not fair that night owls are expected to be quiet for the morning people when they go to sleep. But then when the night owls are trying to sleep, the morning people are like the loudest people in the kitchen banging around. And I don't know. I just feel like there's like this superiority complex with morning people.
I agree. It's like so annoying. Everything starts so early.
Gotta be honest, this is my first time hearing the term morning lark. I've always heard it as early bird, but this is more, I like it's more specific. Like the type of bird is like more specific in this case.
Yeah, I don't think larks are, because I know owls are pretty predatory.
Yeah.
They're able to eat a lot of things.
I mean, it makes sense. A morning lark is an early bird. Like, so I think it's like, I'm going to start using morning lark now. You know, personally, as if you want to become a early bird morning lark, just have kids. I have twin toddlers now, and they force you to become a morning person because my son wakes up 6 a.m. every day on the dot, guaranteed. And now I have to, like, it's, I myself am also a night owl. I thrive. Like, my most productive hours when I'm working or writing something or like editing is between 12 and 3 a.m. That's like when I get the most work done. And it is, it's been a struggle now that I have to wake up at 6 every day. Yeah.
Oh my God. Do kids really wake up that early?
Yeah, they do.
Sometimes earlier, if depending on their age. Since you said you were a night owl, Yejin, do you do most of your writing at night?
I would say night is my favorite time to write because everything's quiet and you could just concentrate.
And it's cool. Like the cool air helps too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's also helpful because the world is so quiet during the nighttime, less distractions and less emails coming in from the morning people who are demanding your attention. Are you more of an outliner or do you like do writing sprints? Like what's your process like when you're writing?
I definitely am more of an outliner. but I'm so like envious of the people who can just, you know, just go in and draft and not even have to plan anything. Like, I think that's super cool, but I feel like I will never be able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of your writing process, we love to learn more about our authors and their journeys to becoming a writer. So can you share a little bit about like your origin story, I guess? How did you start writing, and when was it that you decided that, hey, I can write a novel?
Yeah. I feel like I've always been into writing. Like when I was younger, I would just write stories throughout my childhood. And I have attempted like different novel manuscripts in the past, like during high school. I wrote like, or tried to write a couple of different manuscripts, but never really finished them to completion. And I also like to read like fan fiction and write my own fan fiction, because that was like easier than putting together an original story a lot of the time. So that's something I've always enjoyed doing. And then during high school, I got to go to different writing programs and like kind of meet young writers like myself who like really inspired me to seriously pursue writing and like think about publication.
You said that you've written other manuscripts before, and like we've had authors on our show where, you know, they always have like a novel in the drawer before they get like their debut book published, but on the rare occasion they do like go back to their drawer and pull out that manuscript that they worked on before publication, and it does get published into like a sophomore or like junior book later. Was The Last Soldier of Nava a manuscript that like was kind of sitting around for a long time and you had to like go back and work on it, or was it something that you like picked up after being like, okay, like this manuscript is not working, let me work on something new? And yeah, like just curious as to like when you started writing the manuscript for The Last Soldier of Nava and how it got to publication.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of a yes or no, yes and no answer to that, because the manuscript itself was never like shelved or like something I just had in my drawer, but I did like use some of the characters. Like the main characters in my book are kind of recycled from like a previous manuscript that I did have sitting around. But the story itself, I like wrote that after my first year of college. I had just done this like really amazing study abroad, like summer creative writing program in Paris that was super cool. That summer I like didn't know what to do over the summer. Like everybody had stuff lined up and like internships or programs or things like that, and I just like happened to stumble across this program that looked really cool, and it really inspired me to come home after and like write this manuscript. And I felt like when I did start writing it, I like knew that I really wanted it to be published, or that I wanted to pursue publication for it. And so yeah, I like feel like I guess I did get some help from like my past manuscripts in like reusing some of the characters. But the story itself, I just wrote like on its own, hoping that it would like get to readers someday.
So like when you were like shopping around for agents, when you were sending out query letters, was it with this manuscript or was it with something else?
Yeah, it was with this manuscript.
Oh, okay, great. Like, I mean, like, that's really lucky. I mean, obviously, yeah. You worked very hard, so it's not just luck. But a lot of the times when it comes to querying the manuscript that authors are querying, it doesn't make it to publication. So, yeah, that's like a great feat for someone so young. I mean,
thank you.
I am very curious, because you are you're someone who like knew you were gonna be a writer, and you like you mentioned, like you went to like writing programs, and you like spoke with other young aspiring writers. And I don't know, like was that something that like your family was like encouraging of? Because, you know, we've talked to a lot of Asian American writers on the show, and their journeys are all very different. Some of them went to law school. Some of them were scientists, and they decided writing is something that, you know, they've always wanted to do, and they go back to it, or they discover later in life that writing is something that they can do professionally. So I'm like, what was it like for you as someone who is a young writer who kind of had your goal in sight?
Yeah, that's definitely like a super relatable thing. Knowing like Asian American parents, I'm pretty lucky to have like chill parents, I would say. They never really like discouraged me from pursuing writing or wanting to be a writer. I mean, they might have been like a little skeptical of it because they don't know much about publishing industry or anything like that, but they just kind of let me have freedom to do what I want. And I tried to be proactive in like seeking out writing programs and like things that could help me become a better writer. So yeah, that's just something I kind of did on my own, I guess. And I like definitely do think I got lucky in querying with this first manuscript and being able to get an agent. I think it's just like a stars aligned kind of situation, because like Asian fantasy books are like taking off, or were taking off at the time I was querying, and agents and editors were like looking for stories like mine, and so I was able to kind of like slip into that for sure.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that lack of a better word, trend with Asian inspired fantasies, and recently we've been seeing more Korean mythology inspired books. Some that can come off the top of my head are The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea by Axie Oh, Wicked Fox by Kat Cho. I think there was another one on the Kumiho, which is also like a nine-tailed fox. Very popular character in Korean mythology. And, you know, this was not always the case. Like, we kind of had to carve out our own, like, little subgenre in fantasy, which was dominated by like European medieval fantasy for a very, very long time. So what are your thoughts on specifically Korean diasporans reimagining their mythology for the English reading audience?
Well, I'm all for it, of course. Like, I love that Asian fantasy is so popular right now, and that different East Asian authors and especially Korean authors are in a sense like popularizing tropes or like reclaiming tropes or premises that have been deemed like cliched. Like, I feel like there's a lot of tropes and premises that people have sort of written off as like overdone or cliched, but it's like it hasn't been done yet by certain communities, if that makes sense. And so I just love that marginalized communities are being given like a voice to sort of reclaim these things like through their works and approach it from like a different way.
Yeah. Before we get into talking about your debut novel, I want to roll back a little bit, because you mentioned that you dabbled in fanfic writing. And I'm always curious when our authors mention this, because I'm curious if you're willing to share. Can you let us know what your specific fandom was that you wrote about? Ugh.
I feel like I had multiple, but like there was a time period when I was really into like Harry Potter fanfiction. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because people are still so into Harry Potter fanfiction, and there's like so many books coming out right now that are like reimagined like fanfictions of Harry Potter characters. Like, I don't know if you've read Alchemized, but I know that's like
Alchemized, which was adapted from Manacled, which was a very, very popular fanfiction. Yeah, like that got like six-figure deals, and like now there's like a movie deal attached to it, which is wild.
Yeah, that's just so crazy to me. But I guess like, yeah, everyone was into it or is still into it.
Yeah, I mean, fan fiction is like a nice practice into like honing your craft. And yeah, it is like a little strange that something that used to be, I don't know, like kind of like alternative is now like mainstream. And now that there is kind of like a pipeline to traditional publishing, and they're actually, I think most recently the fandom that's getting like a lot of attention in terms of fan fiction writing is Heated Rivalry. And like, I would not be surprised if like 2 years from now, we're going to get like a bunch of books that used to be Heated Rivalry fan fiction.
I mean, isn't like BL stuff in the fanfic community kind of like it's like a core memory or core function? I don't know the right term for it, but like it's, you know, I know there's a lot of like, I'm like too old to like be slash fiction, right? Is that the term?
Oh, or, my God. No? Slash fiction. That is such an old terminology, you old man. I mean, like it's funny because like for a lot of people in the Heated Rivalry fandom, it's like their first foray into fandom, so like they don't really know much about fanfic etiquette and like how to kind of navigate that space and how tagging works. I mean, we're going into a totally different topic that I thought than I thought we were going into, but I mean, fanfiction writing is not anything new when it comes to creative writing. I mean, look at Jane Eyre, which is written by one of the Bronte sisters. That was kind of like a fan fiction from Pride and Prejudice. You have characters who like share the same name, and it was just kind of like a what if situation. It was a reaction to it was a reaction to how the public enjoyed Pride and Prejudice. So it's just like, yeah, fan fiction has always kind of existed, and it's a great way to practice. Moving on. for our listeners who are unfamiliar with your book, can you give us a quick elevator pitch on what it's about?
Yeah, so The Last Soldier of Nava is a Korean-inspired fantasy. It's about a character named Shadow who is brought back from the past, like sort of reincarnated into the present, and is seeking revenge on her father, who is also the ruler of this country that is being torn apart by like environmental catastrophe and war. It's also sapphic.
Yes, it's very important. It's also sapphic. So, like, your debut novel actually released in the UK last year, and I'm very surprised because you're an Asian American writer, and the American publishing date is, you know, it's this year, it's this month. How did that happen?
Yeah, I just, like, initially signed with HarperCollins UK just because there was an editor from that team who, like, was interested in my book. So that's why it released last year first in the UK. And now this year, like, the HarperCollins US team is releasing it. But yeah, I didn't have a say over the dates.
That's so interesting. I don't think I've ever come across like an American writer who like got a UK deal first before, you know, their own countries. And you know, like an Asian-inspired fantasy getting picked up in the UK first. I don't know. That's also like very surprising. What did you have any? What was like the reaction from UK readers when your book came out last year?
I feel like it was fairly well received in the UK. Obviously, I'm not from the UK, so I'm like less familiar with like UK readers and what they're into, but I do feel like they are really huge lovers of fantasy. And I wanted to kind of like spread Korean culture and Korean mythology, and like I wanted audiences to partake in that, even if they're like not from here or from other places in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I've also really been enjoying like the growth of like Asian American fantasy novels, right? And you know, I'm a Chinese guy, mm-hmm. so like I'm not familiar with the Korean folktales, Korean myths, but it's been kind of cool to see the overlaps between, you know, like the Korean mythology, Korean folklore and Chinese folklore, and like where things are similar, where things are different. So I'm really curious, what were some of the Korean folktales and mythologies that you drew inspiration from for The Last Soldier of Nava?
Yeah, so I think it was mostly like, well, the setting itself, it was inspired by like Korean history and like the Joseon dynasty, especially like the hierarchies of power and like the palace or like kingdom that story is set in. But I also wanted to incorporate like different Korean creatures, like mythological creatures, into the story. And so you'll see like animals and things like that throughout the book that are reminiscent of Korean folklore. Like, for example, three-legged crows are like a part of Korean mythology, and they're like featured in the book.
Also, I mean, like, we would be remiss to mention the deer in the cover of the book. Deers are also a big symbolic animal in Korean culture. And also, I think Taoism as well, with, like Marvin mentioned, there's a little bit of an overlap there. I'm Korean American, so I'm a little bit more familiar with Korean folktales than Marvin. And we do have an origin myth on how the sun and moon came to be. It's the myth of the sister sun and the brother moon. I'm curious, like, did you draw from that folktale at all when you were writing about the moon bearer and the dawn bringer, and just like this origin story before your book actually begins? For our listeners, there's like a prologue before the book. It's very much like Avatar: The Last Airbender. It was like long ago. This is what happened, and then you get into the story. So,
yeah, I actually like didn't base that off that specific Korean myth, but it definitely fits. Like, now that I think about it. I kind of have just always been interested in like the dichotomy between the sun and the moon. And I wanted to, I guess, in thinking about this like past world of Nava that I've created, which was more about like the environment, I wanted to sort of think of something grand and symbolic and like celestial that could represent like the falling of a past world or like a lost world. And so the sun and the moon is just what came to mind.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of world building, you know, I'm always interested when you talk to authors who write fantasy, because world building is such a huge part of like that genre. Did the world of Nava come first, or did the story come first? Like, what's your process like in world building and then creating a story within that world?
Yeah, I guess the world of Nava came first, in the sense that I was sort of imagining like kind of utopia or past world in which people had a different relationship with the environment. And so I wanted to build a story around that, or calling back to that. And I was also inspired by a lot of different worlds. Like, for example, Studio Ghibli, I feel like they feature things like deer a lot in their movies, and like natural symbolism like that, that I just find very beautiful. And I wanted to incorporate that into my story somehow.
Yeah. And like, there are also characters with different powers. I mean, we'll get into Shadow, the main character, in a little bit, but you have characters who are able to manipulate sand, manipulate light. How did you come up with the magic system for this world?
I feel like I love like elemental powers. Like, of course, I love Avatar: The Last Airbender. I think the power to control like different elements is super cool. And it also like a lot of time correlates with the character's personality, like depending on what they have power over and what they control. So I just knew I wanted to, I knew I wanted them to have elemental powers to kind of go with the whole nature theme. And I just thought of like different names for different abilities and how I could sort of set them apart from each other. And then I also wanted some characters to have abilities that were more unique. Like, obviously the main character, she can control darkness, but no one else really can. And then characters who can control sand and things like that.
Yeah, I'm always just so amazed by like the amount of like just creativity that goes into like building worlds, building systems, magic systems, and even and on top of that, you also, you know, your book also includes palace court intrigue and politics and just like all those, like, I like personally, I don't know how I could keep all that together without using like a spreadsheet or like one of those like red thread board thingies.
Yeah, it definitely was hard to keep organized.
Oh, wait, yeah, Scrivener. Like, are you a Scrivener user or do you use a different software?
I've never used Scrivener. I'm like curious as to like, do you like Scrivener?
I personally have not used it, but a lot of authors have, and you know, like, it's really interesting because a lot of the authors who are like really into outlining and really into like, you know, the red string board, like mapping out their plots and world building, they love Scrivener because there's a lot of like, there's a lot of ways to keep track of like very minute details. And we also know authors who have used like softwares to make mood boards. Did you use mood boards or like what, like, or did you have like a soundtrack while you were writing?
I mean, honestly, no. Like, I guess I'm a pretty boring writer because I just like sit down and write, and I don't do like, I don't really make. I know people make like playlists and mood boards and things like that, but I don't know. I guess I'm not really interested in that.
No, it's not. It just means that you're straight to business.
Yeah, I gotta be honest. My creative process is also very analog. I have moleskins all over my office, and I literally have post-it notes for like outlines that I do on my wall. Like, yeah. It's all like, I've tried using Scrivener and also all and other like online note-taking things. I can't get into it. Maybe it's because I am a little bit older, but I just need the tactile feel of paper to like get my ideas down.
I don't know. I guess it would be nice to like make it more pretty. Or like make planning more pretty, but I don't know how to do that.
I think TikTok has really kind of like made planning into like an aesthetic. Like, it has to be pretty. Like, you have to use pretty stickers. You have to use like these like beautiful illustrations for your notebook. And it's like, no, writing is messy. Whatever it takes to get it done, it does not matter. But let's talk a little bit about your main character, Shadow. You mentioned that, you know, they have, you know, an ability that no one really else has. They have the ability to control darkness. And they are pretty much like a mythologized weapon of destruction. They are an assassin. So can you tell us how you came up with the character of Shadow? And also, like, Shadow is kind of an unreliable narrator because she has memory lapses. So I'm just curious how you, like, developed her as a character.
I'm very interested in characters that, like, I guess, like, one of the themes in the book, I feel, is about identity. And so I'm interested in characters that have certain identities forced upon them or, like, roles that they are made to fulfill that they don't necessarily want or live up to. And that's like, I feel like that's a common trope in media. Like, for example, in Marvel, like the Winter Soldier is the character I really like because he is just kind of forced into a role that he doesn't want to be in. And so that was kind of my thought when writing this character, because she is like, she's considered like a more powerful being, but is like really just a girl at the end of the day. And I'm interested in like the dichotomy of that. And I also am interested in like memory and the role that memory plays, like whether individual or collective memory in a story. And so I think that she has like a lot of different memories and dreams that are not necessarily like cohesive in her mind. And that obviously reflects on the story, like the external story and like the timeline of things. And it's like she kind of can't trust her own self due to like this fracturing of her memories and the fracturing of her identity. And I feel like I'm very interested in characters that have like complexities like that. And that's what I was thinking of when I thought of her.
Yeah, I mean, personally, It's one of my favorite tropes in, like, I guess action storytelling is like the tortured former badass, right? Or the person who, like, the veteran who, like, you know, wants to live, just wants a quiet life, but then the world keeps dragging them in, like the John Wicks or like the,
one last
the X-23s, right? Yeah. There's something really interesting about that story, which is like, you know, like, is it possible to be forgiven for things that happened in the past if you're trying to, like, live a better life now?
Yeah. And just like how we're shaped, like, by our environment or like where we were raised and stuff, and yeah. How flexible or inflexible that is, I guess.
Yeah. And I may be reading too much into this, but like, you know, this is an Asian American book club, so I see everything through that lens. And like the fact that, like, Shadow grew up controlled by her father, by handlers too, and who seeks to control her even now into adulthood, it read like a very Asian American, like, allegory to me. Like, was that what you were going for, or am I, like, kind of just thinking too deeply here?
No, I definitely feel like that was a theme, maybe not like consciously when I wrote it, but looking back on it now, I definitely feel like a lot of Asian Americans can relate to a story like that. Like, sort of having a lot of trauma about your family and, like, childhood and growing up in an Asian American family.
Also, just how some toxic Asian parents can pit other kids against you and, you know, compare your abilities to theirs constantly, because you have, like, other quote-unquote prodigies who are very good with their powers, and you have Shadow who has to literally fight them and kind of, like, prove herself every single time. So one of these characters is her love interest, Scarlet. Can you talk a little bit about how you developed Scarlet? Because she is the literal opposite of Shadow in terms of, like, her elemental power and also kind of her personality.
Yeah, Scarlet is a very, like, I would say, difficult character. And I'm also a big fan of difficult characters, especially, like, female characters, or, like, unlikable characters. I always love to, like, watch movies or read stories featuring characters like that. And so I knew I wanted to write a character that was very, very prickly, I would say, but who at the end of the day, like, has a good heart, even though they might not be able to express it or they don't know how to. And so she was definitely, like, my favorite part of writing the book, because her character just felt so, like, alive in my mind to me.
Maybe it's because recently I've been, like, revisiting, like, Shadow and Bone and, like, the Grisha verse. And for listeners who are not familiar with that series, it's like you have, like, a male shadow summoner and you have a female sun summoner. And, you know, there is kind of, like, this dark romance and kind of like a toxic relationship in that series. But I was just, like, thinking, I was like, wow, like, this is a sapphic love story, but it's kind of like in reverse to that kind of relationship, because they are they're enemies to lovers. They don't get along in the beginning, and then eventually they're able to, you know, bond and kind of, like, be vulnerable with each other. Why was it important for you to have their sapphic love story in this fantasy world?
I feel like I just wanted to write a sapphic story. Like, I don't know if I have, like, more motive behind it, but when I created these characters, I just knew I wanted both of them to be, like, girls or women, and I felt like it only made sense for them to develop, like, a kind of romance, because they are, like, complements of each other. And I love Shadow and Bone, so it's so funny that you brought that up, because I definitely feel like that was an inspiration for this book. And now that you mention it, it is funny that it's kind of, like, swapped, because I would say the more difficult character has, like, power, like, light summoning power, whereas Shadow, who is, like, more of a gentler character has like these scary powers of darkness or whatever. And I guess that just goes more again with like the roles that they're forced to play, or the identities that they have to uphold. And so, yeah, I just wanted to write like a sapphic romance, because there are a lot of like similar romances to the one in Shadow and Bone, I feel like the Darkling and what's the main character's name?
Alina. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like there are a lot of romances like that, like straight romances. But I felt like I didn't see a lot of sapphic ones, especially in like Asian fantasy. So I wanted to do that.
Yeah, I feel like shadow powers, like we've seen that in like television books, web comics, and it's always a dude. Mm-hmm. So I was actually quite surprised that, you know, your main character Shadow was a girl, and she was like also very much like, I want to be left alone and not like someone who had, you know, big ambitions and like was really deeply involved with the court politics. So yeah, it was surprising to me as a reader. And I just love the fact that the sapphic love story, like that just came so naturally to you, because I can imagine publishers and editors being like, this is a little much. Like, this is, you know, it's already an Asian inspired fantasy. Do we have to add like a sapphic love story on top of that? So, curious, like, was your publisher, was your editor, like, were they just like, yeah, like, I can get on board with this sapphic relationship, let's develop it more? Were they very like encouraging of you as a writer on that front?
I definitely think so, because when I wrote the story, I didn't see this romance, like the sapphic romance, as like the center of it or like the most important part of it. But then when I like pitched this book and I got editor interest or agent interest or anything like that, like they wanted to market the story as like a sapphic romance, and they really wanted to like emphasize the fact that there was a sapphic romance in there. So I feel like they actually like not only welcomed it, but they like really encouraged it and like wanted that to be like a focal point of the book, which like I was fine with. So
it does feel like the industry in general is more at least accepting of like of sapphic, of like BL type stories, because it's like it's become marketable, right?
It was not always the case. Yeah. We've been around the block for a while now, so we're just like, oh, okay, attitudes are changing.
Which is
like,
great.
There is an inch of progress.
Yeah, which is great. It's great that people like, you know, because we've always known there was an audience for, like, for those of us who have like, you know, braved the fanfic circuits for many, many years. We always knew there was an audience for this, and now it's like, now there's actual proof, which is great. Which is like, I'm glad that it wasn't a arduous journey for you to get the story you wanted to write through.
Yeah, there definitely wasn't like that much resistance or anything to it.
Yeah, like I said, progress. So like you mentioned like Ghibli earlier and like environmentalism, and obviously, you know, Princess Mononoke came to mind. You have characters who are riding deers. So like one of the themes in your book is about how power and like the wish to possess something, like with complete ownership, it destroys the natural balance. And, you know, you have a character who controls darkness, a character who controls light. So obviously yin, yang, lots of balance in the themes there. Why did you decide to incorporate like environmentalism into your story? Because you also have these dead zones where just like there are pockets of land that are just coming into decay because like what had happened was you learned that one of the two dragons has been like killed, and that kind of killed the balance of the whole world. So can you talk us through why it was important for you to include this theme of environmentalism and natural balance in the story?
Yeah, I've always been very interested in environmentalism and themes of environmentalism and like whatever I read or watch. And so I really wanted to write a book like with including those themes. And I also love the I guess, parallel between an environment and what is happening to the environment and like personal character development and character arcs. And so if one of the themes in the story is like about Shadow and her identity and being controlled all of her life, I wanted to reflect that in sort of this external environment that's under decay and is also being controlled, and how balance can never be achieved as long as that's happening. And so I was inspired by a lot of like sci-fi stuff I've read, or the Dead Zones. Like there's a sci-fi book I really like called Annihilation, where the environment is basically just being mutated or like changed. And I find concepts like that really cool. So in writing the Dead Zones, I was thinking about like environmental catastrophe in general and how slow and like encroaching it is, and how destructive it can be on a community, and how this reflects like the more internal struggles that the characters are facing.
Yeah, like Marvin mentioned earlier in this podcast, you do have some like politics in it. You have a court intrigue, and the country that they kind of share a border and also have conflict with is this country called Asanai. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's the thing with fantasy novels. You read it out loud and you're like, I've never come across this word before. Hopefully I'm pronouncing it correctly. Where did you get the inspiration for that country? Because Nava, or I guess like later they're called Iksong, is, you know, kind of based on Korea. So I'm curious like what the inspiration was for the other country.
Yeah, I feel like the conflict between Iksong and Asani.
Oh, Asani, okay.
Yeah, but I feel like that was like a little bit based on like Japan-Korea conflict. And Asani was a bit based off like, because they have like an imperial palace and an emperor. And I feel like that is like vaguely Japanese. And yeah, I would say it was like kind of based off that.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the Bone Warriors were pretty cool. Was there any like inspiration for, like, what was the inspiration for that?
I guess like in thinking about the environment still, like it made sense to me to use bone as like another natural element, I guess. If we're talking about elemental powers and how it can be used as like a weapon, I guess, and also a mask, because the Bone Warriors are using bone as like a tool of destruction, but also like as a sort of armor or costume, and they're sort of wearing like decay on their own bodies. And then their larger mission is like to encourage decay of the world. And so I just thought that visually it would like make sense.
Yeah, like visually seeing humanoids in wearing bone armor is pretty badass. It kind of reminds me of like the demons from Inuyasha. I know I'm like pulling out all these fandoms, but yeah, like those are also like Asian inspired fantasies, so there must be some ties there. We're kind of like going towards like the end of our time here, and it's your cover is gorgeous. I mean, like, to be blessed with a beautiful cover for your debut novel is always, you know, it's always great. But on top of that, your book has a special edition with the Locked Library, which is a subscription service. And it looks absolutely beautiful. So like, what was your reaction to like, at first seeing your original cover and then getting the news that you're also going to have a special edition?
Yeah, I was really lucky to have such a nice cover. Like, I know I've heard other authors like complain about their covers and things like that, but I feel like my publishing team was really generous with like letting me have input on the cover. And they would like just always ask me for my feedback on what, if I wanted to change anything or anything like that. So I had like a little bit of say, and I was just very happy with the artist. It was Jason Lyon who did my cover. He's a British Chinese artist, I believe. And he did a really beautiful job, like incorporating the deer and like these vibrant colors into the cover, which I love. And I was also pretty floored by the special edition. They have like a, it's like sort of embroidered pink cover. And then on top of that, like a recolored paper cover on top. And there's also like character art inside and just like a lot of different elements that brought the story to life. And yeah, I love it. I wish I had more copies of the special edition, but I have one right now.
I mean, it's called a special edition for a reason. Yeah. So like, are you working on another book? I mean, I hate asking this question because you just came out with a book and it was like years of work. So are you working on another book, or what's next for you?
Yeah, for me, like this book was written a while ago because publishing is so slow. Like I feel like so much time has passed since then. And since then, I have been working on other speculative projects. I'm interested in like exploring new genres and switching up genres, whether YA or adult. And the most recent manuscript I just finished is like a sci-fi cyberpunk work in progress, because I'm a big fan of that genre. So I'm excited to see where that goes as well.
Yeah, it sounds like a fun way to exercise those world building skills in the cyberpunk genre. I'm so excited for that. But well, good luck on your future endeavors. Again, congratulations on the debut of the American debut of your novel. And thank you so much for joining us on Books and Boba. It was great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was Yejin Su. Her debut novel, The Last Soldier of Nava, is available this week at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba online bookstores. So if you enjoyed our conversation and want to check out Yejin's book, head on over to booksandboba.com. Check out our bookshop link. All purchases made on our online bookstore support not only us here at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstores. So I definitely appreciate everyone who's bought a book from us so far. And yeah, before we go, just a quick reminder that this month's Patron's Choice Book Club pick is Sunshine Nails by Mai Nguyen, a Vietnamese-Canadian family comedy about the Tran family who have to band together to save their family-owned Toronto nail salon when it is threatened by gentrification when an ultra-glam chain salon opens across the street. Again, thanks to our patrons for helping us pick this book to kick off our summer reading season. As always, if you are a Patreon supporter, don't forget to join our ongoing discussion of this book on our members-only Discord server. The reading schedule is posted on Discord as well as on Patreon. As always, we love to include the feedback of our members in our discussion podcast episodes whenever possible. And yeah, I guess that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Yejin Su for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone. Especially for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts. part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.